Hello and welcome to the Turning Point magazine podcast. Turning Point is an independent, reader-supported publication dedicated to uncompromising journalism, critical analysis, and systemic perspectives. In a media landscape dominated by fast-paced headlines and abstract geopolitics, we look beneath the surface to examine the mechanics of power. We investigate the critical points of modern society, from shifting labor dynamics and digital rights to the evolution of global movements. We don't just cover where the world is heading, we show where it could go if the people had the power to decide.
Today we speak with Sara Jaffe, an independent journalist, author, and a podcast host whose work centers on the politics of power. Sara's reporting has been featured across publications like The Progressive, The Guardian, and The Washington Post. And she is also the author of acclaimed books such as Work Won't Love You Back and Necessary Trouble. She joins us today to unpack the realities of modern labor, capitalism, and the new forms of labor resistance. Sara Jaffe, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Could you, Sara, I have already checked what you have been publishing over the years. Labor has been a central topic to you for, we can say, at least 15 years. Could you a little bit describe your background and how this topic has been in your reporting?
Well, like most people, I have to work for a living.
Yes.
And I don't like it very much. So that's the short answer of how I got to be a labor reporter. And then the slightly longer answer is that I was looking around at the world of, you know, especially 2008, 2009, when I was in journalism school, and there didn't seem to be very many people in the US in particular, but kind of anywhere that I could find in a language that I could read, who were dedicated labor reporters anymore. There were a few of us at the time. There are somewhat more now. It's come back into style a little bit to be a labor reporter. But really, it was a case of like, we're in the middle of this massive economic crisis and we're not talking about people's experience in the workplace very often. Or if those conversations are happening, they're being had by the bosses. So that was what led me to start covering labor as a journalist. And obviously, when you start, you know, trying to learn that, you end up reading a lot of histories, a lot of sociology, a lot of academic works, and getting to know the people who are labor scholars in various disciplines. So a lot of my work has always drawn on that kind of academic research, even when I wasn't doing it myself.
Yeah. I wanted to actually start from your most recent, not most recent work, but most recent book, which you published in 2024 with the Paul Type Books, with the title From the Ashes, Grief and Revolution in a World on Fire. The book, the title already tells it's about grief, it's about revolution, it's about world on fire.
Yeah.
And it literally starts with burning American police cars in 2020. And also you address some personal life events that you were going through. Mm-hmm. So the book was obviously quite long in making. So I wanted to ask you if you could explain a little bit the process behind the book and also its central themes, what led you to pursue this topic?
Yeah. I mean, the short answer is that my father died and it completely turned my life upside down. And I was already, and again, I was already a journalist. I was already covering work. I was already covering social movements. Like everybody, I was living through the COVID pandemic. And it just struck me that so many of these stories that I was already covering were, in fact, also stories about grief.
Mm.
And I, you know, in some way, I just wanted to write the book that I needed when I was going through it and didn't really find anything that sort of talked about grief in both a personal and political context, which is how, you know, that's how I understand my life. It's how I understand the world, is thinking about things, not just how they impact me, but how that in turn is part of the way the world is shaped. And it seemed really clear to me that there's not a lot of space in capitalist society for grieving. You're supposed to get over it and get back to work. And the fact that it is very hard to do that, actually, and that millions of people every day are doing it anyway, it seemed important. And then, you know, I was thinking about this while I was writing the previous book. I started work on the book known as Work Won't Love You Back right after my father died. And so this book was sort of percolating in my mind while I was writing something else that in turn had been percolating in my mind for, you know, years before that. Yeah, so I look at grief through my own life, and I also look at grief through the movement for Black lives and broader struggles against state violence, through immigration, through deindustrialization, the COVID pandemic, and climate change. So that is basically what the book is about in five very long chapters and a few little short snippets that are about my life.
Yeah. And on this regard, I wanted to ask you also, because the question for me is that struck me with your book, because, you know, when I was growing up, when I became adult, mm-hmm. also like social and political subject, mm-hmm. I felt that there was a lot of optimism in the air. There were, you know, concepts mm-hmm. like joyful militancy, that you have to yeah. incorporate kind of optimism in your daily life, also yeah. in your struggles. But now also yeah. when I look around, we see a lot of very large-scale wars. We see even genocidal wars, absolutely mm-hmm. devastating climate problems. And I do see also yeah. a lot of genuinely sad people around me. And sometimes these, mm-hmm. you know, concepts of joyfulness feel even inappropriate in some mm-hmm. situations, yeah. that something has changed. So in this regard, what do you say also related to this changing social atmosphere? How does yeah. grief become a politicized emotion or communal mm. practice? How can it help us to face the world?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to say that like people should feel anything, right? People can be joyful, people can be grieving, people can be both at once. The problem, I think, is often that like we are sort of compelled to perform some sort of emotion or other, right? Arlie Russell Hochschild writes about emotional labor as the work of sort of managing your own emotions in order to produce a certain emotional state in someone else. And so this is, you know, it's a condition of a lot of service work, but it's also just a condition of life on Earth. And particularly, again, if we are required to sort of put on a certain affect in order to be able to do our political work, like I don't know what that's helping mm-hmm. to insist that we should be any one set of things, right? That said, like I think it's less that I want to say everybody must feel grief, right? That will happen at various points in your life, whether you like it or not. It's not really a choice. But to actually just make space for it when it does happen, that seems really important, because it's just not, you know, it's not easy to be joyful sometimes. Looking around at the state of the world right now, it's very hard to be joyful sometimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and even things like, it's a really beautiful but very hot day today in London where I am, and it is very unseasonably hot. And so it's like, oh, even if it was like a nice sort of morning to go outside and people are lounging around in the park, part of my brain is going, and we're all going to die because climate change, you know? And yeah. that's just true. It's just in the air in a way that pretending it's not just feels sort of unhelpful and more to the point, like we're being asked to pretend everything is fine all the time. And what if we could just actually be really, really honest that like, we're not okay. Things are not okay. There's a lot that needs to be transformed in order to keep this planet livable. And we're not doing it fast enough. And in fact, there are, you know, many people trying to go in the opposite direction, even faster. The amount of people trying to build data centers right now is absolutely bonkers. So, you know, I think being honest about both what we're feeling and why seems important to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And in your book, you also assert that grieving can be also a creative practice, no? Like, grieving is not just something passive or something that is time taken off from something else, but it can be, how you say, even like necessary or creative component of imagining different ways of life.
Yeah, I don't know that I would say creative. It is quite destructive, but sort of the reason that the book's title is From the Ashes, it's obviously it's a line from a classic lefty militant song, but also because after the sort of rupture and transformation of it, right, sort of after the worst has happened in some ways, you can't just go back to the way things were before. And so you do sort of have to learn to see things differently, to do things differently. And in that space, I think there's a lot of, there's a lot of transformation that happens to people, again, sort of whether we like it or not. It's not always good. I think, you know, I think a lot of the turn to the far right and fascism that we're seeing now is also a product of grieving in a lot of ways. So I don't want to sort of say, like, if we just grieve, everything will be magically better. But I think that the sort of enforced denial of it means that it comes out in other ways, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. And I wanted to bring you now towards the theme of our month, like labor, which is also one of the five central topics in your book, no? We ran this month's theme under the headline, we say, "The worker is dead, long live the worker," which for us kind of captures somehow that something has fundamentally changed. We have to recognize that. But also labor, let's say organized labor, is a resilient institution. No, its labor movement is longer than many nation states, for example.
Yeah.
And in your book, you also, in quite similar way, you say that labor unions have taken a big hit, let's say. And quote unquote, you say that with the destruction of the unions meant the end of the whole world that the unions had built.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you from this, how do you see, where do we stand in, let's say, 2026? What do you mean by the world that the unions had built? What happened and where are we now?
Yeah, I'm writing specifically there about deindustrialization, and in fact, specifically about the closure of the coal mines in Britain. So, which is something that I imagine a lot of your readers and listeners would know is Margaret Thatcher did this on purpose to try to destroy the most powerful union in the country. It was not because Margaret Thatcher cared about the environment. So the destruction of this entire industry, which had employed, you know, at its height, some millions of people, it destroyed towns, right? Entire sort of places that had been built around the mines or hollowed out. People left because there are no jobs there anymore. The people who are still there are kind of, you know, the services have been hollowed out because, again, there's nobody there anymore. And the union itself had been responsible for creating a lot of the social institutions that existed in these mining towns. So the miners' welfare hall would be where you had your wedding. It would be where you had a beer after work. It would be where you had your funeral. And these were spaces that were maintained by the union. That in a lot of places, the National Union of Mine Workers had, you know, invested a lot in things like political education, but also entertainment, right? That they would pay for maybe the football pitch where your kids would play football. And all of this, when the union goes away, when the union has no more money because it's not getting dues from the workers anymore, the union is, you know, a shadow of its former self. It still exists, but now it only represents retirees. Then that world goes away, right? The social spaces that were made for the people who were going down the mines are now gone and we don't need them the same way. I like your theme that the worker is dead, long live the worker. Because it is kind of true that a certain kind of work is it's not gone completely, but it's rapidly shrinking. And in its place, there are different types of work that have different conditions that you have to be able to think about the ways they organize us, right? The ways that, like, doing work on your smartphone, right? That driving for Uber or, you know, delivering food for Deliveroo or whatever app it is, right? Is a very, very different work process than showing up every day and going down into the ground to dig up coal. And that doesn't mean it's not work. And that doesn't mean it's not important work. But that in order to think about it politically, you have to understand how it works and how it works on us in order for us to then organize workers, right, in a way that they can actually have political power. So, you know, in some ways, the labor movement is resilient. In other ways, it's clinging to shrinking populations of certain kinds of workers and often missing the new kinds of workers that are taking up much, much more of, you know, that are jobs that many, many more people are doing now, that you can't just organize the way you would organize a coal mine.
Absolutely. And on this remark, as you have also followed unions more than one continent,
yes.
I have seen, not only geographically, also economically, I wanted to pursue this new form of workers. What do you see? What are the new forms of life, of labor?
Yeah.
What are the new frontiers of labor resistance?
Yeah, we're in this fascinating moment too, right? Because we are going through this massive transition with, you know, so-called generative AI and companies laying off workers that they don't think they need anymore and then realizing that they do actually still need workers and hiring them back. Automated taxis that then break down and you can conveniently set those on fire too. I was writing about that this year. When you look at the taxi industry, this is a perfect one, right? It's something I think about a lot. You had taxi drivers, right, who were often organized, like the London black cab drivers are like a famous sort of worldwide, everybody knows about the London cabbies and the test they have to take to learn the entire city of London. And then Uber comes in and you don't have to learn anything because the app tells you everything, right?
Yeah.
And they're not organized. And then as they start getting organized, well, the other thing that the app was doing the whole time was it was learning how you drive around London, right? It was recording all that data from all the drivers and now feeding that into replacing them with robots. So now we get robot taxis. None of this is solving the actual problem of traffic and whatever in cities. And, you know, I say this as a bus goes by outside, right? Like, we don't need robo taxis in London. We need more bus routes and air conditioning on the buses because it's really hot right now. But you know what I mean? Like, it's not, this is not a solution to any real problem that anybody had that, oh no, we need robot taxis. That's going to something, right? The solution is that the robot taxis presumably can't organize. The point is to replace the workers. But if you look at this as like a process of de-skilling the work over time, you have gone from the cab drivers who had to learn everything because A, there weren't apps for it, and B, this was like a skilled industry that people understood took time not just to be able to drive, but to know your way around the city such that somebody who gets in the back of your cab and says, I need to go to Newington Green, you know how to get there from wherever in London you are. That work gets de-skilled, the wages go down. The workers who are driving for Uber tend to be immigrant workers. They tend to be people who had less bargaining power in the economy anyway. And then now they want to de-skill us even more by just having a robot. And maybe, probably, actually, for all of these robot cars, there's somebody sitting in an office somewhere, possibly on the other side of the world, where they can pay them even less than they can pay, you know, immigrant workers in London, to watch a screen with, you know, maybe five different Waymos on it. And when one gets stuck, they come in and drive it remotely, right? And these are the things that are happening with a lot of these drone operated various things, robot deliveries and such, right? There are still workers in the mix, but they're not you know, you could have them do more work, right? You could have one driver looking at five cars rather than one car. You could have them looking at the car just only when it gets stuck rather than having to actually pay attention and drive the car. So it's trying to drive down at every turn the amount of, you know, willful, messy human labor in the process. And the fun thing about the Waymos, though, that we learned in Los Angeles during the riots around the ICE deportation raids was that you can just call them to a place and set them on fire and then just call another one and they'll keep coming. Because there's not a human who looks at that and goes, I'm not going there.
Yeah.
Right. So that was a very funny sort of exploitation of the glitch in it.
Yeah.
But it also shows, right, like, what is the labor disruption going to look like now? Because it's not going to look like all of the workers who work in a single factory walking out and shutting down the factory until they get their demands met, right? It's going to look like the entire city being the site for struggle. And, you know, the Italian autonomists would call this like the social factory, right? The entire social space is a space of production in some way, whether it's, you know, housework in the home or any number of other things that are happening out on the street. So to understand this now and understand it sort of geographically and sociologically and like politically, right, is to understand like how thoroughly the work process has changed.
Absolutely. On this regard, I wanted to continue also on this topic of AI. Because earlier this month, we published an article from China, from the healthcare system of China, which is, in some respects, the front line of AI adoption in the healthcare.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And we have some nurses saying to, you know, saying to the reporter that sometimes I feel like I'm helping the robot more than the robot is helping me. And what I take from here is that AI robots, it's not that they are making labor redundant, no? It's just kind of shaping the way what is needed from humans. And in this case, for example, is needed some, I don't know, troubleshooting, interpreting interpreting commands, translating between the human patient and the robot. What do you take of this? What does this kind of turning laborers into a little bit of kind of assistance for the robots is a devaluation of the, how you say, skills?
Yeah. When we think about Taylorism, right, the original sort of design of the assembly line so that every worker is just doing the same sort of small repetitive movement over and over again, and you can swap in and out different workers with relatively little training because they've just got to learn to do one tiny piece of the process, not to build a whole car, right? If we're thinking about that sort of classic auto factory thing, right?
Yeah.
The whole goal of that is to de-skill workers, devalue workers, right? And turn you in some ways into, you know, an assistant to the machine. And this has been, you know, and this has been true the whole course of industrial labor has been, right, increasing the volume of the machines that can do the work, right? And this is something Marx wrote about, and this is something that organizers and troublemakers and labor movements all over the place, I've already cited the Italians, so I'll talk about the Detroit Revolutionary Union movement in the 1960s and 1970s in Detroit in the US that was led by Black workers who noticed that they were always the ones who got the crappiest jobs and had to do the work the fastest and the hardest and sort of got thrown up against the machine in the worst ways. And so now we're seeing this again, this process is happening over and over again with AI, but it's not fundamentally different just because like, ooh, the AI is very smart and sophisticated. It's really not. You know, but like when you look at the things that like, again, that the Italian autonomists wrote, that Marx wrote in the Fragment on Machines, that the drum workers wrote, this understanding that like the point of it is to control labor more and more and more and more. And I write in the Grief book that like it's often capitalists don't really care if they can replace us with machines so long as they can force us to act like machines. Right.
Yeah.
And so what the AI is doing, the AI can't really, because it's not actually, you know, my awful joke, which is a very American Saturday Night Live reference, is artificial intelligence, which is neither artificial nor intelligent.
Yeah.
Because it's not, right? It is just you know, generative AI is plugging in words based on frequency. So you can't remove the human from the process, but you can get the AI to do a lot of the tasks. And then you throw in a human to fact check it at the end or to do whatever it is you might need to do, right? To troubleshoot the code you're writing with Claude Code or whatever it is. And to understand that, like, this is the same process as those, you know, auto workers in Detroit were facing. It's just another machine that can do part of the task and therefore drive down the cost of labor, drive down the value of labor.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you also more about this AI topic because its impact on labor in the, let's say, past 5 years since the launch of ChatGPT has been like absolutely wild debate. Yeah. Like some people say up to 90% of labor will be replaced. Some people say, well, let's take it easy a little bit. But, you know, there is a lot of confusion about what is its impact on labor. Now that I look at it, the latest estimates are much, much more conservative than than earlier. But still, I wanted to ask you about this. How does it look in terms of data at the moment, but also in terms of, let's say, sentiments or working class subjectivities, because this threat is there, whether it's real or imaginary, no?
Yeah, I mean, important for me to say that what I'm not is an AI researcher. So I do not know, I have not done any detailed studies on which jobs are replaceable by AI. I don't know. I tend to think that mostly they're overselling themselves because they need more investment dollars and more government contracts. And, like, you know, the thing that's happening is, like, Google is, like, turning its search into just, like, fully AI. Does anybody want that? Jury's out. Doesn't look like it. Every poll of the public opinion, this I am following more closely, every public opinion poll about AI finds it getting less and less popular. And if you look at the resistance to building data centers, this is a thing that, again, I'm really fascinated by. And again, when we're talking about, like, how, what does labor resistance look like now? Despite what the British government would tell you, AI data centers do not actually require a lot of workers once they're built. They are not job creation sites. They are places to take away jobs. But it doesn't take a lot of workers in one. So you've got a potential interesting choke point there, is all I'm saying. But the challenge that we have now, right, is, I mean, A, these things are, you know, setting the planet on fire even faster than we already were. B, part of the reason that they hype this stuff, in addition to trying to get funding, is also to make us think it's inevitable, right? Mm-hmm. To make working people think that this is just how it's going to be, and we either have to use it or, you know, whatever, it's going to come for us anyway. We don't have a choice. We can't stop. We can't think about it. We certainly can't regulate it or ban it or destroy it. And that's just not true. It's not inevitable. These are things that are being made by a set of people who are making decisions. You know, the British government decided to throw its weight behind data center construction because, I don't know, these are supposed to be smart people who sold themselves as being the adults in the room, and they do not seem terribly smart to me, but, you know, hey. But that's a choice that could have been made otherwise. And at, like, every juncture of this thing, right, like Google making a decision to ruin its search already and then just completely end it and give us just AI something something, that's a choice that nobody asked for. Nobody did a poll that said, hey, would you like to keep Google? Personally, I, you know, Google's a great example of it because it is, like, this is a massive public resource, right, that people rely on for many, many things every single day. I'm literally going, like, are there even other search engines out there, right? Like, what, because Google had become so ubiquitous. And now this company can just decide to ruin it. And we can't do anything about it because it's private. So, you know, it teaches us an important lesson about privatization of resources. And this is true of the whole history of the internet, which is, it, this is a section of my book, Work Won't Love You Back, where I write about the history of computer programming as a job, as a career, as an industry. And, you know, the whole history of the thing is government money going to fund something that then gets privatized.
Yeah, let's go actually a little bit more into your earlier book. You mentioned the title Work Won't Love You Back. The subtitle reads, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone. It's quite explanatory. But
does what it says on the tin.
Yeah, it tells exactly what is going on. But could you explain a little bit, what are the central topics, arguments you pursue in this book, which came out in 2021?
Yeah, so that book is about, again, it's about a change in the way we work, and it's specifically about the idea that people should love their jobs and how that became common and a demand that we are expected, and like what comes along with that demand, right? That we should love our jobs. That, you know, I'm arguing that we should understand that as a demand, not a wish, again, that like people didn't wake up one day and go, gee, I'd really love to do wage labor for a living. That's not how that happened, right? And so the idea that we do this work because we need fulfillment is, you know, historically inaccurate, but it does something, right? Again, and when I'm talking about needing to understand the way that work is organized and the way that work organizes us, what does it mean to have our lives organized around this idea that we should love our jobs? What does that allow our jobs to do to us? Well, I do not think it does anything good, basically. Yeah. So that's, you know, yeah. So that's that book. And it goes through 10 different workers in 10 different industries, profiling workers, and then talking about the history of that work and how it's changed, and then winding up each chapter with those workers organizing to improve their jobs or sometimes to escape them.
And how does that play out with our earlier discussion? Because on the other hand, we see it as this devaluation of labor, devaluation of skills. For me, it seems increasingly difficult to love your labor if you are just, you know, assistant to the robot. So does this mean that these are happening at the same time? You know, we have this kind of devalued labor and then labor based on devotion. I don't know. I'm, for example, journalist. I believe for me, this applies quite a lot, no?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, here I am. Yeah. I think one of the things that made that book both sort of possible, like it made it possible for me to conceive of it, and also made it like a book that, you know, has gotten around the world enough that people are still asking me about it 5 years later, is that I caught it at a time when this was changing, when people were beginning to realize that loving your job was not improving your life. And then again, COVID happened. I finished the first draft of that book in February of 2020. And then in March, we were in lockdown. And so I did a bunch of phone calls during lockdown, calling the workers that I had profiled to ask them how their work had changed. And in fact, one of them had died of COVID. So, you know, when we look at this history, you can catch the moments where it's changing, where you're seeing it change, and when it like when the process sort of becomes visible to people that like, oh, wait, maybe loving my job hasn't gotten me anything good. And so then you saw things like wave of organizing at places like Starbucks coffee, right? Big dramatic strikes in Hollywood, a lot of healthcare strikes and organizing after, during and after the COVID pandemic, right? That these are the jobs that people are expected to care about. And whether they want to do them for themselves because, you know, being a Hollywood writer is pretty cool, or whether they went into healthcare because they wanted to help other people. Either way, this the pressure is becoming much more obvious, right? And I think that's, you know, as conditions are getting worse, you can't sort of just say, but you love it, right?
Yeah.
As it just gets completely, totally miserable and you might die for, you know, going to the workplace.
Yeah. And then the next question is, what is the connection here? Because first we're talking about grief, which for me at least somehow involves some component of, I don't know if love is the correct word, but I mean, usually you grieve over something that you have emotional relationship towards, no? So what is the connection here? How do these two topics, two social emotions, relate to it, each other?
Yeah, I
or
think,
how can we relate
you know,
to
I I mean, I was talking to somebody about this. My friend had posted this quote from another writer that was talking about like the Johnny Cash school of obsession. And, you know, Johnny Cash, country singer, had put out these like three compilation albums that were Love, God, Murder.
Yeah.
And they were saying like, you know, most writers, you can sort of find the scratch it and find the obsessions. And my, obviously I'm obsessed with work. But I am kind of also always writing about love. I'm writing a book right now about heterosexuality. So like, you know, it is kind of a thing that's happening in everything I'm writing about.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so to think about that, like, what does it mean to live in this world that tells us we should love our jobs and not each other? And what does it mean, you know, and we're seeing examples of this all over the place now, even as the far right is growing and becoming more powerful and frankly scaring the crap out of me. You're also seeing people choosing to take care of each other everywhere, right? And the resistance to Donald Trump's ICE in this term, in this, you know, his second term of office, is one of those things where you look at it and you go like, people are just refusing to accept that we're disposable. And they're doing that in ways that is are often putting themselves at risk, you know, and it's not just sort of nice, cuddly, whatever. It's really, really militant, right? The people are facing off with armed agents of the state in the street day in and day out at incredible risk to themselves. And so I think to understand the power of those sort of human connections, right, is to understand why the bosses and the politicians are always trying to sort of grind them out of us.
And this, I believe, brings us also to the wider, in this case, urban space. No, it's not only a question of workplace, but all the
right.
social relationships
Absolutely.
In the neighborhoods.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's really true. The way that people are connecting up, like I'm really fascinated by tenant organizing now, right? And the way that tenant unions, you know, Tara Raghavir, who's an American tenant organizer and the founder of this National Tenant Union Federation, she's like, you know, we are where like the CIO was in the 1930s. Is we're growing really fast and we're coming up with new tactics and they don't really know how to crush us yet. In the way that like there's a very well-funded union busting industry out there, right, that has spent a lot of time figuring out how to wreck labor union drives. There is not yet, and I'm sure there will be soon, a very well-funded playbook for how to crush a tenant union, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really fascinating to watch that happen. And it is, again, it is people organizing literally where they live.
Yeah. And this starts already bringing me towards kind of conclusive thoughts, because for example, this last theme that we, I mean, conclusive in a sense that where do we go from here? Yes, this last theme, for example, the theme of your book, Work Won't Low You Back, is something because I have also moved through a lot of political organizations or social movements or NGOs or cultural spaces that are not economic per se, can be, for example, let's say the tenant union. Sometimes we see this, you know, this devotion to what you do, no? Whether it's labor or something else, paid like salary work or something else. We see it playing out also in these kind of spaces, no? Like spaces that are claiming or are saying or pursuing to, I don't know, resist or subvert capitalist relations. What lesson can we draw from here?
Yeah, I think it's important to not reproduce the dynamics of the capitalist world in our organizing, you know? And
it's a good
that
rule
at the
of
same
thumb.
Time. Yeah. And I, you know, I mentioned this in the book, Malkia Cyril, who's an incredible organizer who has also done a lot of writing about grief, hosts this gathering on Zoom and asked me to come speak at one of them. And they started out the event by talking about, you know, and Malkia's parents were in the Black Panthers. They called themselves a Panther Cub, which is great. And, you know, and they were saying, like, who taught us that, like, we were going to make the revolution by just working all the time? You know, that, like, the work ethic, it's not going to be just, like, applying yourself to it and throwing yourself at it is going to work. It's got to be something else, you know? And that doesn't mean that sometimes, you know, when you're in a union and you are, you know, counting down to a big strike or a big vote or something like that, you sort of throw yourself at it for a while. But like, that can't be the way we do it all the time, because you will burn people out. And, you know, I mean, the labor movement, frankly, has relied on this a lot, of just like a constant sort of churn of young, enthusiastic activists who, you know, finish school and are like, I want to do something good in the world. And then they, you know, become an organizer for like 2 years until they're so exhausted that they quit. That's not great for anyone. It doesn't allow people to actually stay in the movement long enough to learn some things and then pass down the things that they're learning. So, you know, Ellen Bravo, who is one of my labor movement aunties, Ellen was involved in 9 to 5, which was women office workers organizing in the 1970s. This is what the movie starring Dolly Parton is based on, is the actual experiences of these office workers. Most of them didn't kidnap their boss, but still. And Ellen would say, you know, everyone is important and no one is indispensable. That people have to have breaks, and the movement has to understand that, you know, especially when they were talking about like women workers, they had caring responsibilities, they had children, they had parents to look after, they had other things to do other than just be in the union 24/7. And so the movement had to reflect that in a way that like the workplace doesn't, in order for the movement to actually be strong and resilient. It has to take into account something other than just replicating the values of capitalist production.
And in all of this equation now, my main question, what is the role of the labor unions? Are they dead? Or they can also become part of this equation?
They really need to not be dead, because we still have to work and it still sucks. So
that's, you know, absolutely true.
Right? Like, it's really important, actually, to still be organizing around the workplace, because the workplace still exists. They have not, in fact, figured out how to replace us all with robots. Don't believe anybody who tells you they have. And we can still make a, you know, dent in the production process. But it's hard, right? I'm a member of the University and College Union here in England now, because I'm a graduate student. And I do some teaching, and like, there are layoffs happening all over, and, you know, it's really hard to win a strike when the boss wants to fire you, right? When they want to get rid of you, then when they want to eliminate your job, not just like fire you personally, but like fire a third of your department, say, or 2/3 of your department, or close an entire campus. The old tactics don't work, right? I quote my old friend Joshua Clover, who passed away last year, in actually both of these books. I think I quote Joshua probably more than anyone else. But he writes in Riot, Strike, Riot about what he calls the affirmation trap. Mm-hmm. And it's just this, right? That it was like, once the company wants to shut down the factory and move it to Mexico, Bangladesh, China, you can't win a strike, because they want to shut it down. So You shutting it down for them is just doing what they want. And then they just fire you all and, you know, they move it to China. So we're seeing that in, you know, in academia too, right? It's not just an industrial labor problem. Whenever the boss wants to get rid of you, they're taking away one of your strongest weapons. So we've got to figure out some other forms of leverage. And look, if I had fixed this, then the British university system would not be hemorrhaging jobs right now. I have not solved it. I would really like to solve it, but there are, you know, other people who've been thinking about this for longer than me. So the challenge is really like, where and how do we fight? Where is the leverage? Who needs to be on side with the universities? It's obviously the students, right? And what are our demands and where are they coming from? You know? And when it comes to work, which I do not think we should love, when we're trying to save jobs, why and what for, right? Are we trying to save jobs because people need money to live? Well, that's a, you know, problem we could solve. By, you know, sadly, it requires overturning the entire capitalist mode of production. But still, right, if the robots can do what everyone says they can do, I would still like one that would clean my bathroom for me. We don't have those yet. But yeah. Like, if they can, say, do all of these things at some point, okay, then why does Elon Musk get to keep all the profits, right? The generative AI was trained on, among other books, mine. All I get is a $3,000 check from Anthropic? That's not enough, right? That's my work. That's your work. That's tens of thousands of other people's work that is being swallowed up and spat back out at us by these algorithms. Okay, why does Anthropic own it, right? Sort of like Google, this should be a public resource, if indeed it can do what they say it can do, which it mostly can't. The debates about data centers, unions really got to figure it out on that, because, you know, the building trades are saying, sure, we'll build data centers, and everybody else is saying, wait a minute, right? I would like labor to not buy into the idea that this is inevitable, but also to be thinking about, like, okay, well, if this technology can do some of our jobs, what of our jobs do we want to hold on to? What are the things we do think should still be done by humans, right? Do you want a robot nurse? I don't. But, you know, if I could get a robot to clean my bathroom, I'd be perfectly fine with that. These are big questions that I think, among others, unions should really be talking about and trying to answer, because these, you know, these massive social shifts are coming for us. And while they are not inevitable, if we don't fight them, they will be.
So you are saying that we should set or aim somehow beyond labor.
Right. What would it look like if we actually, you know, the language during COVID of essential work, right? Who were the essential workers that had to keep working? That was actually like a really interesting moment to think about. Like, what work is essential? It wasn't the guys on Wall Street. You don't need them. But like, the people in the meatpacking plant were so essential that they died in massive numbers to keep feeding people, right? Yeah. What does it look like to like take these questions seriously? If the AI guys say that they can replace all human labor with whatever, okay, then I say we can transform the world system in other ways too. We don't have to just let Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos decide for us what's going to be automated, what's going to be done by robots, and who's going to own the results.
Absolutely. Final question. We already talked, unions already once created a world, no? This typical example of mining town, for example, education, political formation, culture. Now, let's say that world is dead, at least in parts, transformed in other parts. What can be the world that not only unions, but also social movements in larger way are creating at the moment? Where are the new openings? Putting all this together, which direction you see in this specific juncture that we are living in?
Yeah, I write a lot about the folks in Minneapolis in my more recent book. I think I write about Minneapolis in every book, but particularly in From the Ashes. And Minneapolis really showed us what it was like to resist Trump, right? To resist the intrusion of armed agents of the state into every community. And unions were a huge part of that. And the movement in Minneapolis, and I write about this some in the book, I've written about it a bunch since, is really incredibly networked and connected in a way that a lot of others are not, where unions and community organizations, tenant unions, faith groups, new things that just came into existence around the fight against ICE, they all work together and they sort of organize together on the principle that like we can win more together than we win alone, right? It's a very basic labor movement principle, actually. And that means that even when something is not like quote unquote your fight, you're still in it because it's actually a fight to make life better for everyone. So the unions in Minnesota that represent building service workers are out there fighting ICE, in part because a lot of their members are immigrants, in part because nobody wants armed agents of the state kidnapping their neighbors, and in part because they understand that as unions, they have some power, that, you know, they have some leverage that other people don't. And so applying that to making demands of the state, to straight up fighting the state, watching the way that's worked has been really incredible to see. It's not perfect, but they won. And they drove ICE out of Minneapolis, and they have not gone back into another city in the same way. ICE has had to redo its strategy. And I think it's really, really important to claim those wins when we've got them.
Absolutely. I think Minneapolis has been one of the inspiring examples of the late times. Years of effort somehow manifested in very strong way in the beginning of the year.
Yeah, it's been really amazing to watch from a distance and to just be in touch with people who are going, you know, going through it, because, you know, it's like this is what they were training for, you know. And yes. It's really incredible to watch it work out and, you know, go, oh yeah, we were right, this works.
That was Sara Chaffee, a journalist, researcher, and the author of several acclaimed books on labor issues. This talk was brought to you by Turning Point, an independent online magazine dedicated to uncompromising journalism and critical thoughts. If you enjoyed the discussion, please consider supporting our work with a donation. Your support keeps us going.